This week on Writers, Inc.
You know, like any art, if you have some limitations, it's kind of good because, you know, it keeps you from spinning your wheels or, you know, whatever.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc.
Yeah. You went to go see Dan Brown last night. I want to hear about that. I was supposed to go tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. How fun was that?
I did. That was fun. So he lives in Rye, which is a couple miles down the road. And we've got this place called Portsmouth Music Hall right in the middle of town. And like he does every kind of like big announcement there. So he had something, you know, just for like local people. I don't know if they actually sold tickets to it or if it was like an invite only thing. But like, he filled the place. His dad came out and introduced him, which is really cool because like I've never met his dad before. But his dad was really funny. And his dad used to be a professor at Phillips Exeter Academy. That's where Dan went to school. So like it kind of explains a lot, you know, like all of his heroes when he was growing up, they were all professors. So kind of, you know, you can see where his mind was at. But, you know, honestly, like sitting in the crowd, just watching him do this, you know, they had a local DJ, you know, interview him. Like he is just the consummate professional. Like, you know, he's just very good at just, you know, delivering the one liners. And, you know, like I've got my notepad out as an author, you know, because like if you've ever been interviewed in that kind of situation, like it's stressful. And like he makes it look so, you know, so effortless. And you know, and the book itself is fantastic. I'm about 100 pages or so into it, and it's great. You know, 8 years between titles, you know, that part sucks. It'd be nice if you could get them out a little bit faster, but it's a solid book.
Yeah, I was gonna say he put like what is this the fifth one in the series now?
I think so.
Yeah, because he put out, I feel like the first four came out pretty like, at least the first three, I think, came out pretty like, you know, like you expect. And then they got a little bit longer.
Yeah. So he initially wrote a standalone. And then he wrote the first, you know, the Angels and Demons book.
Yeah.
And then he wrote another standalone. And then, you know, Da Vinci Code came after that. But what was interesting is he's had the same editor this whole time and they work very closely together. Which, you know, like I do that with Patterson, you know, like we're on the phone, you know, quite a bit while we're writing, but for the most part, if I'm doing a solo title, you know, I send the editor the manuscript at the end, you know, after my agent reads it and everybody else does. But his editor is hands-on. And they've got a weird system. I'm like, you know, like this book, like if you think about it, like they kept it quiet. You know, like nobody got advanced copies of this thing. You know, nobody saw it. Nothing leaked out. And he kind of went into what they did to do that. And he was working off a VPN and basically editing the file directly on a Penguin Random House server in New York that was backed up somewhere else. You know, so anywhere he was in the world, he would basically log into the VPN. But like he didn't keep any files locally. You know, which makes a lot of sense. And his editor was able to log in. For me, as you know, like that kind of scares me just because, you know, like somebody else now all of a sudden has control of your book. You know, something goes wrong with their server, their backup or whatever, and it's gone. Like, I mean, can you imagine being 8 years into a book, you know, the latest Robert Langdon novel, logging in one day and then, you know, like nothing is there.
Yeah.
So, but it was cool to hear all that stuff. And I mean, his tour it sounds insane. Like he was in New York the day before yesterday, you know, on Pub Date doing all the local talk shows. He flew back for this. And I don't know where he went next, but like, I'm sure he is gone again. And he's gone for like 3 months.
He was supposed to be in Michigan tomorrow, but it got canceled and I'm sad.
Oh,
so,
no.
Okay.
Anyway, I don't know, but he's going to Toronto after that, like the next day. So maybe it was just, who knows, too many things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm going to go back to a typewriter because I'm just scared of these AI bots now. Maybe not. But we were talking off air earlier this week about that woman who got one of those scam emails for an unpublished novel.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I'm going back to a typewriter.
I wonder if she, because I had been thinking about that, and I do wonder if, because one thing you see, and, you know, I had actually done this until advised not to, but, you know, usually when you're querying, you put it on like a website, you know, so that maybe you get a bite on it. I suppose the danger in that is that like anyone can just like, search keywords on the internet, find your website and be like, oh, you have this book
It
and
wasn't on her website. I looked. I'm like, oh, they probably just pulled it off her website. Not on her website.
she took
But
it off.
maybe from somewhere. I don't know. But I'm
Yeah.
like, just that freaks me out.
Weird.
The rumor that I heard is that she has a Gmail account. And, you
Probably.
know, like, so e she emails agents from her Gmail account,
Oh,
and
yeah.
everything in Gmail that you send or receive is part of the training data for their AI system. So
Oh,
that's,
boy.
yeah.
Typewriter. Speaking of Kevin, speaking of AI scams, what's in the news? That JD's supposed to say that.
I actually got excited when I saw the headlines because I don't think there's a single AI story in there, is there?
No,
Ish.
maybe. I
Oh,
didn't want to talk
AI
though about
adjacent.
the Anthropic decision this week. I'm sick of it, so we got other
Yeah, I'm a little
stuff.
tired of that. If you don't know what happened with Anthropic, go on Google and Google will tell you. All right. Well, first up, Agent Eric Smith emailed back book club scammers, so you don't have to. Agent and writer Eric Smith writes, "There's a book club scam going around. A lot of authors are getting in their inboxes. I emailed the scammers so you'll know what to look for. The first email promised a circle of, quote, passionate readers who would leave thoughtful reviews. Red flags from this email include no website, no Goodreads, no meetup group. Eric offered to put them in touch with his publisher. The email writer declined and used marketing speak about placing reviews and making connections. Eric then asked what this was about, whether they did blog tours or had a website. The email writer responded asking for a PDF of the book, which has been published for 2 years, instead of taking free copies from the publisher. Then brought up money, tipping readers $20 to $25. This isn't a circle of readers, it's a review mill with bots. Eric again asked for a website. They responded by saying they have 2,000 members, but had no website to point to. Seems completely legit to me. I don't know what the problem is here.
And then he got meaner and the email stopped. But it was funny because I got the exact email that he'd posted.
Well,
I got two this morning. Like they
and
caught
then in
everything.
his post where he talked about it, he like the next day he got a different email that was like almost the same.
Almost
So
the
it's like,
same.
yeah, they're just using like.
I get probably 3 or 4 times a week now emails about my book, The Stepping Maze, and one of them slipped and let me know where they discovered it. It's always an AI written email telling me how great it is, and it calls out all the things that you can discover if you read the book description, as if they'd read it in the book. But they're discovering it through Readsy, and I'm not going to diss Readsy at all, but I had paid Readsy at one point to do like a they did like a full in-depth review or something of the book, posted it on their website, and that's where they're finding it. So
Oh,
I don't know if
interesting.
that's
So
where these guys are doing it or.
are those jobs when you post them to Readsy, are they public facing or do you have to actually log into Readsy to be able to read them?
No, so these are this is this was a thing that was like as an author in the Readsy platform, I was able to pay to have someone actually do a full-on review and post it on the blog or website or something. And so it was about getting people to go buy the book, you know. So it wasn't like a gig or something like that. It wasn't anything like that. I mean, they do a real good job of vetting the people who do this stuff. And so I'm not getting scammed. I want to make it clear. I'm not getting scammed by Readsy.
No.
I'm getting scammed because these people have gone and found book reviews on Readsy and are now using those to try to scam
Well,
you.
that's kind of what I was getting at. Anything that's
Yeah.
public facing that you could basically view, on the internet without having to log into any kind of account, like anything like that is being scraped by the AIs and the news services and Google and everything else and then
Yeah.
populating these systems. The way book clubs are supposed to work, or at least this is the way they work in my world. So at the end of all of my books, I usually put book club questions. So that kind of spurs that. I've got a book club tab on my website. And then there's contact information for book clubs there. Every book club I've ever worked with, and I do a ton of them, they usually reach out. Usually there's like an admin or a moderator for the group, and they try to schedule some type of a Zoom call or something with the group. And we get that on the calendar. Once that's on the calendar, depending on the size of the group, some of them will ask for free copies of the book, which sometimes is fine. The publishers will take care of that. Other ones don't ask at all. But usually we book that particular Zoom call, a good month or two out, to give everybody time to read the book. So then the club reads the book and then you have the call and you actually talk to them. So that's how a book club is supposed to work. And that's the way it's always worked, at least for me and everybody that I know. So like if you're getting emails in any other format that contradict all of that, especially if they're asking you for money, anytime they ask you for money, that's an obvious red flag. But like, in this case, they're obviously just taking a scam that they had run, probably 2 or 3 years ago, and they're just twisting the same data and coming out with a new format for it. But
Well,
it's
and
the
I
same
think
nonsense all over again.
what they're probably doing, and I guess this is why I think it's important to talk about it, is because like I read Eric's post, and it was like really manipulative language too. So like if you're a new author and you're like, oh my God, this is so exciting, like a book club, and you don't think to ask those questions, they don't ask for the money up front. And then one of them said like, oh, up to like 1500. And so they're gonna like come at you with like, oh, now you owe me like $20,000 or like whatever outrageous number that would be. I didn't do the math, but like, there are some people who, can be very intimidated by those types of demands, right? Like now suddenly you get a bill for like $5,000 and then they start using really threatening language. Like there might be people out there who pay it who don't know better. Or, they get told like, well, if you don't pay it, we're going to review bomb your book now. Like, I mean, it can be very scary, I think.
That's why I always send them JD's books.
There you go.
That's a good
Do
idea,
that.
Kevin.
Next up, Kindle Unlimited Library Distribution has arrived. Amazon now allows KDP Select ebooks to be in public libraries without breaking exclusivity. During each 90-day term, your ebook can be distributed only via KDP and libraries. Print and audiobooks can still go wide. Only KDP Select ebooks qualify, and you must own exclusive rights, no public domain content. Your Kindle ebook must remain exclusive to Amazon retail. Libraries are the new exception. To get into libraries, use Draft Digital or Library Services only. Upload your book, then deselect all retailers and select library channels such as Overdrive, Hoopla, BorrowBox, Odilo, Cloud Library, Baker & Taylor, and Palace. Verify rights and publish. It's recommended to set your library pricing at around 2 to 4 times your e-bill, your retail ebook price. Libraries buy one copy, one user, our royalties per borrow models.
I've heard about this from a bunch of different sources, and Joanna Penn was talking about it the other day. And she brought up a good point. KDP, as far as I know, hasn't come out and actually said you could do this, right? Like this is floating around through other sources. So I,
But this
has
has
anybody actually
come.
seen it through KDP, like
They
them
made
giving
an
their blessing on it?
announcement on their website. Like it's been confirmed. I should find the link for that. There's actually a post on it on Amazon in their KDP community.
And I
Okay, because
believe
that
Draft to Digital actually made an announcement about this. And I, knowing those guys for as long as I have, I know that they are not about to tell you something that they haven't thoroughly vetted. So,
No, that's all good because Joanna, I think it was just on her episode last week, she was saying that she hadn't actually found this on the KDP site anywhere, to actually confirm it. And that was the only thing that gave me pause. I personally flipped it on for a couple of my books, not my best sellers. I don't want to risk those, but just a couple just to see what happens. Because I get that question all the time. Because even the stuff that I put out through Simon and Schuster, as it's still technically as an indie author, so I'm stuck with that KDP exclusivity. So like it wasn't in libraries, and a lot of people borrow books from libraries. So this is a really good thing if it sticks.
So you do your ebooks through KDP Select?
Yeah, because the thing is, Simon and Schuster will gladly put them out for me and take a percentage of it. But you know how easy it is to put your own ebook out. Like, there's no point in me, adding a third party to that equation because it doesn't really get me any more. I don't know how Simon and Schuster would handle KDP. My 4MK series is in KDP, and that's through HarperCollins. So I know there are ways to do it through the traditional publishers, but it's not easy. Like even with HarperCollins, like they get a select number of titles that they're allowed to put in KDP. They don't have to adhere to the exclusivity, but that's a revolving door. Those, you know, they don't keep the same titles in there all the time. They put this group in for a little while, then another group and another group. So it's tricky.
Okay, I feel like I'm going to be speaking for a lot of people who have this question, so bear with me here. You're saying that you put your ebooks in KDP Select, the exclusive Amazon platform, and you do not distribute ebooks through other platforms at all.
I do both. So when I release a
Okay.
title, I go wide with it initially for 90 days. So it's available on Nook and Kobo and all these other things. Then at 90 days, I pull it from wide and go exclusive to KDP.
I see.
That,
And
but
I've been doing that. I've been
against
doing that
their
with,
rules.
yeah, if you're traditionally published, can you do that? Like, so if you get a deal through, well, you said HarperCollins has it on KDP.
Yeah, no, it's totally different if you're traditionally published. It's up to that publisher to do it. Like I was saying with HarperCollins, like they've got a certain number of titles they're allowed to have in KDP that's, you know, contracted through Amazon. And they revolve a certain, you know, their titles through that. So, you know, this title will be in there for a little while, then they'll pull that one out and another one will go in. Over time, I've beat up on them and got to the point where they're allowing the 4MK series to stay in there indefinitely, which is good. Because, you know, I've got a ton of readers in KDP, so like they don't want to miss out on that particular audience. But you know, when you do it as an indie, like I've approached it in both ways. You know, I've noticed that if I put a title out and I go exclusive to KDP straight from the release, I see the rankings on the book are much, much better. Like it flies up the Amazon charts. The algorithms love it. You know, so they know that it's exclusive and they're using that. If you go wide, the opposite happens. But I sell a lot of books, but usually that initial sale, you know, like the people that are going to buy them on, you know, the Apple platform and on the Nook and all those different things, they buy it within that first 90 days. And then that usually dries up, which is why I just keep it there for 90 days. I let it dry up, you know, give them the chance to pick it up if they want it. And then I put it into KDP exclusively so that
Oh,
the Kindle
that's
Unlimited folks
interesting.
can deal with it. And then that actually gives me another bump in the rankings because when it goes into KU exclusive, then the algorithm jumps all over it again. So you know, adds a little
Interesting.
longevity to the release.
I am allergic, deathly allergic to KDP Select, so I can't use it. All right. That's a surprising thing to learn about you, JD. So thanks for sharing that strategy. All right, I'm going to move on. Spotify launches BookTok Hub. Spotify and TikTok launched, quote, Big on BookTok, a US hub running through November that turns vital TikTok recs into rotating audiobook shelves updated every 2 weeks. It uses TikTok data and BookTok lingo like current obsessions and audiobooks I'd sell my soul to re-listen to promote both new releases and backlist. Launch picks span A Court of Thorns and Roses, The Song of Achilles, Beloved and Becoming. The pilot tests whether BookTok buzz converts into audiobook listening before a wider rollout. That's interesting.
It is
You
pretty
guys
interesting.
don't use TikTok, right? Are you
I
guys on
don't.
TikTok?
Not,
I
no,
have a
I
TikTok
have a
account, but
TikTok, but yeah, like I don't
I am
really.
also allergic to TikTok, so I can't do
I've
that.
purposely, from the time I logged into TikTok the first time, I've never liked a video or favorited anybody or any of that kind of stuff because I always want to see what the algorithm is just going to throw at me. So like even when it comes to books, like if I, you know, spend more than 5 seconds or whatever watching a video on a book, all of a sudden I'll get 20 more videos about books and you just kind of go down this rabbit hole. I haven't seen anything yet for Spotify on there. I'm not on there a whole lot anymore, but it seems like a good idea. I could see this working.
And I know that Spotify is really kind of amping up there. They've got Spotify for creatives or something like that. Spotify for authors, maybe. So they're trying to kind of amp up that side of their service, and play into audiobooks more. I just don't. I'm not going to listen to an audiobook on Spotify. I mean, I've accidentally stumbled onto it. I plugged in the phrase whiskey blues yesterday. And clicked on the first thing that popped up, and it turned out to be an audiobook. And could not click out of that fast enough because that's not definitely not what I was after. But it's just surprising to me. I don't know. It's just not something It's just not a platform to me that I'm going to use for listening to audiobooks.
If I listened to audiobooks regularly, I don't know. I have Spotify. I like Spotify. I could see using it. I think it's interesting just because, I mean, Audible is fine, but I think that we all get like app fatigue, right? Like, how many apps do you need to do? So, like, I do appreciate that they're trying to sort of like streamline that in a way,
Yeah.
that, you just have to, use one account, one subscription. But I don't know like what their pricing model is compared to Audible or the selection or any of that. So I don't know if, but I suppose I could see the potential for that growth there. I mean,
Yeah.
do you
Yeah.
guys use do you use Audible on anything other than your phones?
No,
No.
I only
Nope.
use it on my
Okay.
phone. Yeah.
See, that's where they've got me trapped. Because like I use it on our Echo devices in the house. So like,
Yeah.
I mentioned I've got a bar in the house, so I might go in there and play pool. I can say, I don't want to say her name out loud, so and so, play my audiobook, and she'll pick
Yeah.
up and just start playing my audiobook over the speakers, right from where I left off. So like it always
Yeah.
it's you know it, I so I guess I'm kind of caught up in that system. If
Yeah.
I wouldn't even know how to work Spotify into that.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I think pricing is going to be key, though. Like, if it's a music and audiobook, I'm thinking about, is that going to save me enough money that I'm willing to change my stubborn ways and try something else?
Well,
So,
that's a good point. I mean,
yeah.
if they're folding it in, because I don't know, and I probably should know, but I mean, if they're folding it into the amount you pay to have Spotify, the truth is though, like I think I actually get Spotify for free because of Verizon or something, and I actually listen to music on the YouTube music app because it links with the YouTube video side. So there are certain music channels on YouTube video that will translate over to the audio. And so sometimes I'll just do that. So,
Then we'll see. It'll
yeah.
be interesting. I think in the future you're gonna see a lot more of like because what you said, JD, like you're kind of tied into one service based on like the ecosystem that you've chosen. I think that there will be a lot more of that. Like, Kevin, like I'm sure YouTube will make some sort of deal with some sort of, company, and
Yeah.
Spotify will, like, it'll probably just start to branch out into
I
these
mean,
very
YouTube's already
specific
got tons of
ecosystems.
audiobooks,
Yeah. We're gonna
just
get
saying.
Audible Music.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess they
Amazon
already
does
have
have
Amazon Music.
music.
They already have
That
it. Yeah.
that's a real possibility of them tying all that stuff
Sounds
together.
kind of
I
like a
can see it.
joke though. Like, how many apps does it take for Kevin to listen to an audiobook? Come up
Three.
with a punchline and email us through the Writers Inc. podcast website.
There you go.
All right, that's it for the news. You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
Okay, JD, who's up this week?
This week, we've got Alma Katsu back on. Alma's a former CIA and NSA intelligence agent turned novelist. She's also a personal favorite of mine because she's fantastic at just walking the line between horror and thrillers. Her latest novel is called Fiend and releases September 16th. Here she is, Alma Katsu.
Well, welcome. I'm so excited to have you on the show today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, it's very exciting, your horror journey, which we will touch on and get into. But we like to target readers, so we want to start at the beginning. What is your writer origin story? How did you get started writing?
Well, it could either be very depressing or it could be very inspirational for aspiring writers. When I was young, I wanted to be a novelist, but this was a long time ago, pre-internet. So I really didn't know how you became a novelist. All I knew, people were giving me advice, you're too young to write a novel. You don't know what life is. You need to go out there and have life experiences. So I had the opportunity to go work for the intelligence community. And I thought, there's a life experience. Well, it sure
Yes.
was. And I had a whole career there. And I didn't return to writing fiction until towards the end of my career. So that's what happened. And I didn't sell my first book until I was 50. And now, 15 years later, I'll let your listeners do the math. My ninth book is coming out.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Yeah, it's so interesting. And I know that you do spy thrillers, that you have the two, but then you also have the horror. I'm curious how, because I don't think the spy thrillers were your debut either. So you come from the intelligence community and you just sort of skip over the relevant life experience and jump straight into
Yeah,
the
it's funny how
genre.
life works. Partly because when you're an intelligence, especially a long time ago when I started, they really didn't like you doing anything on the outside, let alone writing about it. So it would have been hard. And I did try to write spy novels, but they weren't very good, to be honest. And what I really liked was like speculative fiction, dark fiction. And so my first novels were more on the fantasy side, very dark, kind of romantic. Very dark, kind of messed up romance. And but that was sort of dying out. And so I ended up sort of transitioning over to horror. And it wasn't until I was retiring from intelligence work that my editor at Putnam asked me if I would be interested in trying my hand at a spy novel because she knew that I'd always been interested in giving it a try. So that's how that came about. But I love writing horror, so I didn't want to give that up either. By the way, I do not recommend that combination to anybody because it's very heavy marketing lift.
Because those are very different genres in some ways.
And they appeal to different readers. I think there's only a handful of my probably most dedicated readers actually read both.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting how that works because you would think like a spy thriller is a thriller and thrillers are adjacent to horror. And sometimes thrillers and horror can blur so much.
Especially now, I think in the last few years, where we've been seeing such a rise in interest in horror, we're seeing a lot of psychological thrillers that sort of, leap and certainly domestic thrillers. And it does make people want, I mean, there are all these books are about scaring people, what unsettles you, what makes you afraid. And so, yeah, it is a much bigger blanket. But you know how it is. I mean, people read for pleasure. They read because there's certain stories they want to hear, and it's really hard getting them to try something different. And I don't blame them. So as you can imagine, like people who are probably drawn to geopolitical thrillers might wonder why should I be interested in a horror story, and vice versa.
Well, I definitely think Fiend might be that gateway book, but we'll talk about that
Wouldn't that be nice?
in a minute. So what is your writing process like? Do you tend to plot, pant, somewhere in between? How do you approach writing a book?
Well, I'm definitely a plotter, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're thrillers. And so, like, especially if you look at the spy novels, they're constructed, it's very intricate, right? The subplots and all that. And I really hate to waste time. I try to be very efficient. That's a holdover from my days as an intelligence analyst. So plotting is the way to go. But whether it's a horror novel or a political thriller, I always find that after it's been written and my agents have taken a look at it, and usually they come back and they recommend changes that end up really changing the last third of almost every book, right? Like a new twist, it's got to be more surprise. So really in the end, it ends up pantsing a little bit. And I surprise even me. I think the main thing is you got to find your stride as a writer, and you just have to trust your instincts.
I think that that's actually really good advice because every book is a little bit different too. So I know that when you started with horror, you kind of were in that historical horror where you touched on the Donner Party and then you had the internment camps and now you're in the modern day. And then also with your spy thrillers, does that change how you approach, like, kind of constructing the novel and how you think about writing the novel and maybe even how you outline the novel?
Very much so, because with the historicals, you have that sort of the guardrail, the skeleton of history all around you that you have to, you can't run away from it. Or it
Right.
ends up becoming alternate history or something like that.
Yeah.
But, it kind of gives you not only some shape, some construction, but, like any art, if you have some limitations, it's kind of good because, it keeps you from spinning your wheels or, whatever. So in that respect, I really like writing historicals. It's like a challenge, like the story, and how can I change it? How can I embellish on it and yet not get too far away from it, to
Yeah.
still be true to the story in many ways. And I find with contemporaries, because you're not hamstrung by history for the most part, might have a few facts that you have to adhere to.
Right.
That it feels a lot more full of possibilities. How about if I put it that way?
Yeah.
Just to be positive, you can go in many directions.
Yeah, that's true. One does kind of feel more like a puzzle. But you did include quite a lot even in Fiend. Like it feels very like there's a lot of details in it. You know what I mean? Like the companies and sort of it doesn't feel like just some random wealthy family. Like it feels very rooted and grounded in the modern age, which I think might sound weird, but it does. It feels almost like a documentary. I mean, not really, but it
Oh,
does.
thank you.
Did you find that you did a lot of research to get it there, or did that just come more naturally as opposed to where historical? I imagine there's a lot of research that has to go into it.
Yes, not nearly as much research as I do on the historicals. There was some. I think part of the issue, I should say, not problem, is that my agents, there's a pair of them that literary agents, they ask a lot of questions. And when they come back with their notes, a lot of times they do want, more detail. They want it to feel more grounded. So I end up really feeling like really fleshing out the backstory of the characters and the family. And particularly in this one, because the family's history is where the supernatural element comes from. So it had to make sense. It had to be coherent. The family in question is ethnic Albanian, even though, it's been a very successful modern day family. And so, they're global citizens. They live in the United States, generations have been raised in the United States. So they're not Albanian per se, but that Albanian heritage is very important because of the character of Albanians. And
Yes.
I can tell you the history behind that if you want to know. But I'll just say that the Albania is supposedly the origin of the blood feud. These are people who can hold a grudge
Fascinating.
and have incredible tempers. And as you know, that's woven in, that's a, part of the reason for Fiend.
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed that aspect of it. Because it feels like a very like layered novel in a way. Like there's like the obvious evil of, there's some supernatural things and like greed, because obviously, succession is one of your comps that's been making the rounds. But then, there's a lot of quieter evil happening underneath those obvious things, which I think makes it, very compulsive to read. I read this in practically one sitting. Like I could not put it down. I had to know what was going on and what was happening.
It's so wonderful to hear.
Yeah, no, it was very good. The blend of historical and modern just worked so beautifully. But then also you had all these layered things, like I'll keep thinking about things. How do you juggle that when you're sitting down to write? Because especially in the modern aspects, it can be very easy to write a character that ends up being very on the nose versus kind of dynamic and complex and subtle. How do you juggle that? How do you approach writing characters like that?
Well, I wish I had like a game plan that I could lay out. But I think for me, it's when I went to grad school for fiction writing, it was in the old days. And so everyone was being trained to be a literary author, right? So it's all character driven. And you really had to understand your character, and the motivations for everything that happened in the story are all come out of character. And so that's probably it for me, is that I really feel like I have to know these characters and really understand, all the motivations for why they behave the way they do. This is, on one hand, it's a story about corporations and greed and all that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, it's a story about family. And so, luckily or unluckily, I had a very interesting family growing up, a lot of interesting dynamics that I will mine until the day I die. So there, I do draw on some of my own family history for this. What is the tension between siblings, especially when you're in a family like this one, where some, children are not treated fairly? I don't know about you. I certainly grew up always hearing, parents say, "I love all my children equally." And yet the truth was right before your eyes that this was not the case, right? And so these kids, the siblings, are playing for very high stakes in this family and figuring out how to navigate those differences between them and how they're being treated and perceived. And they're doing it according to the rules of this family, how this family fights. And it's very, very dirty and very, very difficult.
I mean, it's almost equally a tragedy in some ways. Like, the story feels very Shakespearean, which, I think Shakespeare very much plays into horror and just the, but it's, I guess that's why I meant it's very layered, because there is the obviously supernatural element, but the horror is almost like the horror of human nature in this way.
Think that's where I end up going really in all my books. It's just, I know it doesn't sound very cheerful, but partly because of the work that I used to do before as an intelligence analyst, you're really kind of exposed to people at their worst nature. But unfortunately, you also see how common that is. It's not like only one in every 100 people is bad. So, when I think of characters, unfortunately, I see to me the whole thing, and I see those negative impulses, and I know that chances are life is going to pull you in that direction. So yeah, it's a little, my stories tend to be a little on the dark side, but I do feel that they're reflective of what I see in life.
I do agree. I think that they come across as very realistic. Like, none of the characters in this book are, I want to say, likable in a way. Like, they're
They're not.
very unlikable people, but they're also very understandable people.
Thank you.
Do you find that it's difficult, especially because, in your other horror novels, there are people you can root for, and then in Fiend, you're not exactly sure who you should root for, if anyone. Was that hard to write? Like, how do you approach living in that headspace of those types of characters for so long?
Well, that really, I guess it really opened my eyes to what a different world I have lived in than most people. I mean, honestly, working at CIA, for instance, and I've described this when I've talked about the spy novels, it is the kind of environment where you're constantly trying, people are constantly trying to manipulate you. You never know if you're being told the truth, the whole truth. You don't know if you're being taken advantage of. And maybe I just was in it too long, I don't know. But I see those aspects in human interaction. I was a little worried about this. I mean, to me, as a writer, I guess, I find a story with really interesting characters to me is very engrossing. And I forget that, there are just some readers who really want to have characters to root for and sympathetic characters and all that. All I can say is this might not be your book. But hopefully, if you pick it up, it's short, and you'll still enjoy it, and you'll get something out of it as a reader, as a writer. I mean, I do think it's an interesting piece of writing for other authors to expose themselves to. And I certainly learn a lot from reading other authors' work. I go out and I try to find books that handle narrative in interesting ways so that I can learn, how did they handle this particularly difficult aspect of whatever, juggling time and space or developing characters. But yeah, that is one thing that kind of hamstrings me, but I'm not alone. I mean, you know how many authors, I don't want to say complain, but we say enough with the likable characters already. Can't we just have realistic, interesting characters? Or maybe watching Succession did it to me, because there's really no likable characters in that show.
Right. Yeah. Especially particularly unlikable female characters, I think, tends to be something that people really want, and yet for some reason can be very get a chilly reception sometimes. Not always, but it can be a little tricky to find that balance, I think.
Yeah, I think it in television it depends a lot on the entities behind it, the production team. Not that I have a lot of experience there, but you can definitely see it. I won't name the author, but I've been involved in something, not a TV production, but something else for this big name author who's written a lot of books. And behind the scenes, some of us who've been involved in it, we've had to acknowledge that this guy is just doesn't have a good headspace for women, right? He's judgmental about the women characters he writes, and he doesn't seem well disposed to women in real life either. That's just a given. And so I think you see that reflected in television. I think the difference here with Fiend is, there's probably more female characters than male characters. And they may do things that we don't like, but you'll understand why they're doing it. I don't believe people are born bad. I believe they're sort of made to be whatever, selfish or defensive, all those things. And so we see that here. And that makes them a little bit more sympathetic, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that, we do being able to see what happened, and all of that just complex and their rationale, like nothing, I know that we always as writers want to go after that surprising but inevitable. And, I feel like this was a really good way of doing that, of showing, just those very grounded psychological aspects of what happens in families like this that are
Yeah.
just so terrible.
And it's so interesting to me too. I mean, everyone, you go through life, at some point in your adulthood, you realize like all of the things that probably shouldn't have happened to you when you were younger.
Right. Yeah.
And you try to course correct. So it's always amazing to me when I see adults who just refuse to course correct and they want to stay in those old patterns, which are destructive, self-destructive. Aren't helping them as adults.
Yeah.
And so it does happen, and not everyone opts for enlightenment. And we see that play out in Fiend, what happens when you can't let go of those childhood grudges.
Yeah, which is very satisfying in a way, particularly when like you're kind of not sure who you should root for. You're kind of like, well, it is satisfying, and sad and tragic, but where did the idea for Fiend come from?
This is the scariest part. It literally just like popped into my head, almost whole. It was slightly different in the beginning. Maris was more of a sympathetic character who ends up getting sort of dragged into the family drama. But personally, I find narrators like that, who are more reactive than proactive, just very difficult to write and ends up being problematic a lot for the narrative. Inevitably, my agent comes back and has comments about that. So I said, okay, I'm just going to flip this around. She's not exactly the character I envisioned, but I'm going to make her proactive in this case. And then the story just, everything fell together.
Yeah, it's always so interesting sometimes how that happens, where you struggle with a character or a plot beat or something, and then you're like, oh, flip it around or change something, and then it just clicks.
Snaps into place like a puzzle. It's great. If as a more passive narrator, she was certainly more sympathetic, so that kind of took care of that issue. But also she just didn't seem to have a lot of agency. You know what I mean? Like she was a nice person, so she didn't want to do bad things, and then something else would sort of happen to her. And I personally find especially female main characters like that kind of tedious. So, yeah.
Yeah, so if you're listening, just go for it. Just go for fully,
Go for it.
proactive, unlikable characters.
Good luck with that.
This might be an odd question considering you write horror and spy thrillers, but what, if anything, do you hope readers take away from your books?
What a great question. Not a lesson per se, although there's usually, I hate to say it, right, but some kind of theme
Yeah.
or, issue that I try to weave in there without being too, about it.
Right.
Mostly, I hope that people appreciate the writing. I try to really put some art into my writing, and I don't feel like I'm quite a 100% commercial writer, where the point is just to make the pages turn. And I try to care a little bit, mostly about the story itself, that it's unique in a way. It's funny because I write horror, but I really don't like cliches. I don't like stories that are just, oh, the standard private investigator, the standard whatever, vampires, werewolves. Although I've written a werewolf story, I like them to be different and to bring something new to the discussion. So I think that's the most I can hope for.
Well, I think that's a good thing to hope for. This has been so fantastic, and I just enjoy talking to you so much.
Thank you. This has been a
Maybe
lot
we
of fun.
can, yeah, close out our show with the same question, which is, what is one piece of advice you would give to new or aspiring writers?
Oh gosh, there's so many. I mean, the most important one I think is to read. Read a lot and read widely. Don't just read in your genre. This is going to sound horrible, but kind of read the best books you can. I mean, you kind of have to read the books that everybody in the reading community is reading. You need to be aware of sort of what trends are out there. Why are they embracing this particular book? Not because you want to copy them or whatever, but you want to be part of that discussion and aware of what's going on in your community. But a really well-written book can help you as a writer, really help you develop and push you in ways that maybe otherwise you wouldn't. So just read, read, read.
Read, read, read. Well, again, thank you so much. Fiend is out today. So if you like complicated Shakespearean tragic horror, definitely grab this book with a touch of the supernatural.
Thank you. This will be my new category.
Yeah, exactly. Tell Barnes and Noble they need to construct a new section.
Well, thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
I thought it was really interesting what she talked about, sort of not going quite as genre hopping as she has. Kevin, you jump genres a bit, and I think JD, you skirt the line between genre hopping. Christine, I think you do too. So what do you guys think about that?
I like having the flexibility, but I've sort of come more and more to think of what I write as all being one genre. I just sort of shift what the MacGuffin is, basically. And because my early days, I wrote sci-fi, and it was like classic spaceships and aliens sci-fi. But I have found that I preferred sci-fi that was more like the absurd meets the mundane kind of thing. Technology 15 minutes in the future kind of stuff. And so when I transitioned to thrillers, a lot of the thrillers I wrote were those same stories. That in fact that's what kind of brought me around. It's like those are much more grounded in like current day. And so you don't want to get too far in the future when you're writing a thriller, because then it does become sci-fi. So you don't want laser beams and spaceships and robots necessarily, unless they're the threat that the hero is dealing with in the modern day. So yeah, I kind of cheat, but I do think that I've written some fantasy stuff, I've written some other things. And what I think it does is, if you can find the key here is to find the common theme in your work rather than the genre. So you could write cross genre much more easily if the readers that love you know that they can count on you for this theme. They're like, Kevin writes fast paced, hopeful fiction. That's kind of my That's the theme I'm going for. And so the readers who followed me over from sci-fi have stuck with me. And whenever I write something outside of the thriller genre now, those same readers will read it because it's a Kevin Thomason book, because that's the genre they're looking for, if that
Yeah,
makes sense.
that's honestly that's the key to it. You have to find that common thread that's going to tie it all together, something that bring people from novel A to novel B to novel C, where it still kind of feels like it's the same sort of thing. And it's funny because like I'm reading this the Dan Brown novel, the latest one, and like precognition is a big thing in the book. But the way that he plays it off, he's still got Robert Langdon running around doing his thing, and like it's part of the
Right.
story. He
Yeah.
gets, it doesn't seem believable. Not everybody believes in precognition, and Robert Langdon
Experience,
doesn't
like
believe in it. So he
her life
basically
and
uses
work
the character to
experience gives
debunk
her
it,
such an
so
interesting
it's not just
perspective on
happening
human
and
nature,
everybody
which I
takes it
do
as
think kind of
fact.
helps
The
with that
main character
horror,
is
really
basically,
amping it up.
poo-pooing on the idea. It's not possible. It's not possible. It's not possible. And then he sees something that kind of proves that it is. So like there's a way to weave it into everything.
Yeah.
Like in this case, I mean, we all know what, Robert Langdon, I think 4 or 5 books in, we know what how he would react to certain things. And if you use that, you can tell the story.
Yeah. In this age, with quantum physics being what it is, weird is okay now. Like you can't predict what the world's going to throw at you now.
It does seem kind of tricky though to go, I guess, from I guess she could do like a paranormal spy thriller, but spy thrillers to historical horror. But now she's getting a little bit closer. Fiend is modern horror, so and I liked, what she talked about, like just sort of like that quiet evil, because like in this book
Yeah.
it's like very clear that there's like something not right, but it's not exactly like obvious what the monster is. And I noticed that she does that in a lot of her books. Like you're not exactly sure what the evil is. How do you create like those layers and subtext in your books to sort of get that tension really going?
It all comes down to that show the monster thing, right? Like the second you show the monster, it's all over. So you have to build up to it and build up to it, because whatever the reader creates in their imagination is always going to be more frightening and more scary than whatever you can actually put on paper. So you've got to, work that in and use it to your advantage.
I watched a video recently about he was talking about games that really pushed the limits on the PlayStation 1 back when that was still, hot, and toward the end of its life cycle, really. But the graphics and things like that were kind of limited on that device. But there was when they released this game called Silent Hill, there was this limitation because it was kind of a free roaming open world environment, but there was a limitation on how much of the world could be rendered at a time. So the world in the distance would be, blocky and look like garbage. So what they did was play on that as a strength. They played on the limitation as a strength, and they set the whole thing in this perpetual fog. And so you were constantly seeing like dark, shadowy figures in the distance, and your goal was to try to find that person or whatever, and they were constantly disappearing into the fog. And so, I think about that. I think that in some ways that's the right way. They did that out of necessity, but that's kind of the right way to present, the bad guy or the monster in your story.
I think you can do the opposite though too. I'm just thinking, because writing serial killer thrillers, you put like sunshine and this person is so nice and they're the
Yeah.
person next door, but then you've got those subtle layers of like corruption beneath that you see peeking through. And I think that's a really nice
Yeah.
technique because it kind of subverts the like darkness and lightning and the things that people kind of suspect. Fog.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so interesting because there's so many different approaches that I think are like so that work, like hiding the monster until like, you can't, but then, making sure that you're not disappointing the reader in a way. So like showing the monster in a way that still like satisfies their expectations, or never really showing the monster in a way, can work. I've read books that do that pretty well, where it's like the monster's killed, but you never really get a sense of what it is or
Yeah.
how it works.
And the reader learns that they were the monster all
All
along.
along. I really liked her advice about reading what the reading community is reading. I don't feel like we hear that very often as advice. Like you hear read widely, but understand what people are going crazy about. I really liked that.
Yeah, it was kind of like what Karen Slaughter said when she was on, like, don't knock a bestseller, read it and find out why it's a bestseller. And I think really staying current and seeing what people are doing, I think that's necessary. I think if you're reading books that are only 20 years old, you're doing yourself a disservice as a writer for
I
sure.
wholeheartedly agree with
Yeah.
that.
Do you guys do that? Do you read like the current bestsellers?
Yeah.
Yeah, for this podcast, you
Not
make
for
us, JD.
years.
Yeah, I do think that, reviewing books and then being on the podcast sort of helps with that, right? Because like publicists are in your inbox about like the upcoming book. So you definitely, it helps. But I think that it is actually very helpful. That's part of the reason why I subscribe to Publishers Marketplace, honestly, is because I do think that, even if I don't read the deals every day, like when I do take a glance at them, it's interesting to see what's selling, and what they're, comping upcoming books to, and sort of like where the reader demand might be going. I think that that's not that you can write to trend, but I do think it's interesting to know, if anything, for marketing, because I think savvy marketing is taking a book and figuring out how to sell it, right? And so like the language you use and like the books you might comp, like it just makes you think about what you're writing in a different way. And I think that that's helpful
Yeah,
for me anyway.
I agree. I mean, I'm kind of joking about for the podcast we do, but I really do try to read what other people are reading and loving because I feel like if you don't do that, you're not staying current. And I think if you want to do this as a career, that's very important.
I've noticed most a lot of well-rounded readers and writers, I mean, tend to do that. They read outside their wheelhouse and like we're kind of forced to do it because we're doing this. I read a lot of stuff just because it's sent to me, like the book just happens to be sitting on my coffee table and it's not something I would have picked up, but it seems like an interesting idea. Then you've got the extreme of that. One of the things that Dan Brown talked about it is his talk last night is he doesn't read any fiction while he's actually writing. Like he's just reading nonfiction after nonfiction. In this case, the book is about consciousness, so it's all highbrow medical stuff, which I guess is good too, but like you don't want to lose the ability to tell an actual story. And I guess if you're reading 100% nonfiction, like it feels like that could go away.
Yeah. But he had 8 years in between to read fiction, so it was
Yeah, you got to mix it up somehow.
all right. I also think it just also sort of like helps remind you as a writer that like, because you're gonna read books that get like super hyped up that are like, instant New York Times best-selling books, and you're gonna be like, I don't really see what was so great about this book. Some books you're going to be like, yes, wow, 100% agree. And other books you're going to be like, wow. And I guess for me, it sort of is a nice reminder that like you're not going to please everyone. And so like just try to let go of chasing that perfection and like thinking that it's always going to be just like a home run across the board. I think it just reminds me that yeah, like you'll find your audience. So just like write in a way that makes you happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. With that, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Johnny B. Truant coming on. Johnny's the best-selling author of Fat Vampire, which was adapted for the Sci-Fi Channel. Other books include Pretty Killers, Invasion, and many others. His latest is a nonfiction titled called The Artisan Author, the low-stress, high-quality, fan-focused approach to escaping the publishing rat race, which comes out in November, November 4th, I think. So Johnny B. Truant.
Fantastic. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.